We do have a quorum to conduct business. Present for the record are Senators French, Stevens, Green, Bundy, and myself, McGuire. First up, we have the confirmation hearing for the State Commission on Human Rights, Karen Rhodes. Ms. Rhodes, welcome. Tell us a little bit about why you'd like to have this position.
Probably the biggest reason is I've known the governor for quite a few years, especially in capacity as my mayor, and we became friends. And she knows of my passion for justice. And it is really sad that in this day and age that we still have a need for people to, address discrimination issues and injustice issues. But nonetheless, we do. And so the opportunity to be able to educate people and change people's minds and opinions about minorities or in the workplace or in the public arena, it'd be a very honorable thing for me to do.
Okay, questions from the committee? Yeah, Senator Green.
I've often wondered how someone who's on the Office of Human Rights, the Commission for Human Rights, how the balance between unjust claims and what we would think of as unethical actions against an employee or an associate, and how do you balance out the rights of the individual versus the responsibility of the employer or the person for whom the claim is against?
You just have to weigh the evidence. You need to look at the history of the employer and see if they've had, other issues with other employees, see if they have a track record with complaints. There's two sides to every story. A lot of people claim things just because they didn't get what they want, so you kind of have to be able to judge the truthfulness of their claims. I am an employer. And so I know what it would feel like to be sitting on that other end having an employee making claims against me. I would certainly hope that no one ever would. In that capacity, I try to treat my employees fairly, and I would take my experience as an employer and compare it to the person who was being accused, and I would, make a judgment from my own personal experience.
Thank you.
Further questions? Senator French.
Thanks, Madam Chairman. Good morning. Ms. Rhodes, have you had any prior experience with the commission? And just let me tell you that I'm not fishing for any problems you might have had in your background. That's not my question. It's just, have you been to one of the meetings? Have you seen how they work? Are you familiar with how the commission is organized and so forth?
I have not been to one of their meetings yet. I have met with Ms. Haley, the executive director, and got briefed on what it is they do and how they do what they do. I'm aware of their existence, but as far as working directly one-on-one with them, I haven't had the opportunity to do that yet.
Okay. And just maybe you can remind me and the public, how big of a job is this? Is this a full-time job, half-time job? Does the commission meet once a month? Do they meet just as cases come up? Tell us a little bit more about how you see your duties and what percentage of your time is going to be taken up by this.
I don't think much. They do have an annual meeting. They're going to have their annual meeting this week, so fortunate to be down here for that. I understand they meet three, maybe four times a year, depending on the level of hearings that they have to review. And so I would say that my active participation in committee would be periodic. I believe that they, once they vet cases and find out who really needs to see before the commission, that they might farm out certain files to commissioners to review and study, and then when they come together as committee, to present evidence and make recommendations, I would assume that that's the process.
Sure. And just remind me, and if you don't know, that's okay, because I don't know, about how many decisions does the Human Rights Commission issue every year?
Based on studying past meetings, it would appear that they have, on the average, 4 to 6 that actually get vetted through the process that actually need to be heard.
Okay, thanks very much. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Okay, further questions? Senator Bundy.
Thank you. recent experience has shown that there are some people who accept appointments to government service and they're not able to attend on a regular basis. Is there anything in your business that would keep you from attending these meetings that
No.
you would be able to be?
I make commitments and I keep them.
No.
And especially, you know, I serve at the governor's pleasure. I have high regard for her, and I would not want to dishonor her by not participating in something she appointed me to. Okay.
And I think I heard you say that you're capable of making the hard decisions and telling people even no, no, even though it would be racially tinged to make that decision.
I wouldn't have a problem with it if I felt and had the consensus of the other members that it was a fair decision. I would not have a problem with that at all.
Thank you.
The only question I have is, has anybody briefed you or talked with you about the backlog of cases and some of the issues that have gone on in recent years on that?
As far as the backlog goes, I know that they did have two personnel positions that were cut, and that caused the backlog to, you know, seriously back up, and the two positions were restored, and they are in the process of catching up on that.
Okay. So you're committed to keeping pace with that?
The desire is to keep pace. It is difficult when a person has to wait a long time for justice. And a lot of times, you know, people move on and witnesses and whatever move on, and it's kind of hard to bring justice if things take a long time. So hopefully that process will be more on track since the personnel is 100% at the moment.
Good. Well, should you be confirmed, I hope you'll keep in touch with us on that subject. It's both the employer and the person in the case of alleging that sit out there without the certainty that I think they need to move forward, and it's been a frustrating experience on both sides. So I appreciate your willingness to step up and to serve the state.
You're welcome.
Any further questions? Okay, hearing none, thank you. Anybody in the audience that wishes to testify? Anybody online? Okay, so hearing none, I will read the motion that would be made in accordance with AS 3905080. The State Affairs Committee has reviewed the following and recommends the appointment be forwarded to a joint session for consideration on the State Commission of for Human Rights, the name of Karen Rhodes from Wasilla, and this does not reflect any intent on the part of the members to vote for or against the confirmation of individuals during any further of these sessions. So does anyone object to that moving forward? Okay, hearing no objection, we'll go ahead and take an at ease and sign it. Second confirmation hearing, and today it is for a seat on the Alaska Public Offices Commission, and we have Shirley Dean who's made it over here, I understand. And so Shirley, would you come forward, Ms. Dean? And tell us why on earth you would want to be in this position.
For the record, my name is Shirley Dean, and first of all, I'm honored to be chosen to be nominated for this. I strongly support APOC's purpose in that the public appointment and public office is a public trust, and I'm an advocate for accountability in government. And I feel APOC's mission is a major key for effective and efficient government. The other reason is I recently retired from the state of Alaska, and I actually have time. I'm not serving on any other board or commission. So.
And you don't want to just read books?
Yes, I do.
Take walks?
I do that, too.
Okay.
And walk my dog.
Okay. Questions for Ms. Dean from the committee. Senator Stevens.
It seems to me that somehow we've created a system that isn't working. We've had the FBI investigations, and it looks like there's an enormous issues out there that the FBI are investigating. So somehow our system is missing issues like that. Yet on the other hand, we've managed to fine the rules chairman of the other body $50 for not reporting something on time. So we're catching those little things and missing the big picture. Do you see something basically wrong with our ethics approach, our whole reason for APOC being, and what do we do to improve that?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, I don't really know. I haven't studied this issue. I'm just brand new, and I've been trying to learn the curve here on APOC's rules and regulations. So I don't feel capable of answering that question at this point.
Questions? Senator French.
Ms. Dean, good morning. Maybe you can just tell us a little bit more about your background. I see you were a former police officer. Where were you, or where did you do that?
Well, I can give you sort of a... I was raised in Ketchikan, and I graduated from Ketchikan High School and went to college and then came back and worked on the Ketchikan Police Department. From there, I moved north and worked on the pipeline, did labor activities, and then came to work for the legislature in the early 80s. And from there, I went to the Human Rights Commission as an investigator, and then child support when they got rid of the office here in Juneau. So I worked for state government for about 17 years.
And I noticed that you had worked for the Human Rights Commission. I was hoping that you and Ms. Rhodes would exchange telephone numbers.
Yes, but, I hadn't.
It seemed fortuitous that you had that
I was an investigator for many years there, or felt like many years.
I think Senator Stevens touched on a really good point, and that is, you know, it does seem like sometimes APOC sort of picks up every grain of sand and misses the fact that it's standing on a beach. But I think, you know, perhaps the public should know, or at least my perspective is, you know, APOC is a complaint-driven system. You don't have investigators. You have to deal with the complaints that come to you. If someone doesn't file a complaint, APOC doesn't have the jurisdiction or the authority to take action on its own. And I think that's just kind of important to get out there so you know. I think there is a request for an APOC investigator in the budget, and that, you know, might change the scope of your agency's activity. Mm-hmm. But for the time being, I think you're bound by dealing with what comes in the door. I'm sure some folks would just want to know, and so I'll just ask you, what level, if any, of political activity you've had in your life? You know, you're going to be sitting in the agency that judges political accusations and claims of, you know, improper campaigning and political, you know, activity. Will there be any concern about you and where you've been up till now?
I don't believe so. I can say in all honesty I am very trained in impartiality, both in working for the Human Rights Commission and child support. I am a lifetime Democrat. I started out in my first very election, was elected as a state delegate from Ketchikan when we did the sort of coup in Sitka back in the early days. And I haven't been involved in party politics for about the last 7 years actively at all. So only voting.
Voting. Okay.
And I'm
a voting for a second.
Voter.
Wasn't trying to make the connection.
Excuse me. Yeah.
My ears. No, it's not your. I don't think it's your voice.
So I don't feel I have any problem at all being impartial or.
And getting back to Senator McGuire's question about your retirement and so forth. What's the level of involvement? What does APOC itself has a group of employees that work every day. You know, kind of doing the day-to-day work. Will your job be a full-time job in the Anchorage office, or do you simply sit and preside over the meetings of the board?
The way I understood it is that I'm just one of the commission members. There's five commission members, and I'll be the Southeast representative and attend commission meetings and do the work with the other member.
I see.
As a volunteer.
Not a paid position. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And that's the way you understood it.
Yes.
We'll see if that comes true. Senator Bundy.
Thank you.
Oh, you're going to pray?
Well, you never know. Sometimes people sell you a bag of goods. We don't.
Yeah.
Well, perhaps you'll have an opportunity to balance Mr. Dapsovich and his strong opinions, knowing him on a personal level. Almost rhetorical question is, not so much in your case, but in many other cases, if you choose to serve in a public arena, if you choose to run for office, you're immediately suspect and often in the public's mind, guilty until proven innocent. And I just wanted to tell you, I was pleased to hear as an investigator that And as a former police officer, you're apt to reverse that and assume people are innocent until proven guilty. It is a challenge in public service when there's so much cynicism and distrust. And I would look forward to you being an advocate for public service as well as someone out there trying to discourage people from serving.
Thank you. Through the chair, I believe in public service. I feel like to be a good citizen, I need to contribute back to what was given me. So I did serve during the Knowles administration on the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, and feel like this is another opportunity to give back.
Okay.
So I'll do my best.
All right. Well, maybe one day we can do public service like jury duty. When they get called, they have to serve, and there are no excused absences.
Well, and on that point, again, just rhetorically, I think one of the things, at least my interactions with APOC have been very positive. They serve, and this is just a file away in the back of your mind. I don't know what all issues you'll end up deliberating on, but one of the things, at least in the Anchorage office, we're able to do as public servants is pick up the phone and call and say, my goodness, this is complex. There's this rule and this rule and this rule, and help me make sure that I do the right thing and file it the right way and so forth. And the folks in our office there in Anchorage have been very helpful. And so I think Senator Bundy's just right on that. Certainly there is an enforcement role for the Public Offices Commission, but certainly there's also a supportive role and an educational role for those that serve. So further questions? Okay, with that, anybody in the public that wishes to testify? Anybody online? Okay, hearing none, then I'll go ahead and read the same thing. So in accordance with AS 3905080, the State Affairs Committee has reviewed the following and recommends the appointment be forwarded to a joint session for consideration. For the Alaska Public Offices Commission, the name of Shirley R. Dean from Douglas, Alaska. This does not reflect any intent by any of the members to vote for or against the confirmation of the individual during any further sessions. Is there an objection to furthering the name? Okay, hearing none. Thank you so much, Ms.
Thank
Dean.
Thank you.
Okay, and we'll take a brief at ease to sign. Record, and it's 9:30, and we're on to our next item on the agenda today in Senate State Affairs, and that is the matter of Senate Bill number 92, Ignition Interlock Devices, by Senator Hollis French.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Good morning. Senate Bill 92 is about ignition interlock devices. The idea is to get repeat drunk drivers put something between them and their cars before they get behind the wheel and on the road. And the ignition interlock device is just that automatic check, which requires them to prove that they're sober before they drive a car on streets that are occupied also by you, me, our friends, family, and neighbors. I'll just read the sponsor statement briefly into the record, if I could, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 92 uses modern technology to combat the chronic problem of drunk driving in Alaska. Ignition interlock devices are used across the nation to prevent individuals from starting and driving their cars while intoxicated. Alaska has one of the highest DUI rates per capita in the nation, and many of those convicted are multiple offenders. According to 2006 statistics, nearly a third of DUI cases in that year involved a drunk driver who'd been convicted of the same offense in the past. The legislation would require the use of an ignition interlock device during the entire length of probation for repeat DUI offenders and first-time DUI offenders that have a blood alcohol content of over 0.15 or greater. In order for a repeat offender to legally get behind the wheel again, an ignition interlock must be installed. The cost of the device is borne by the offender. Similarly, if a judge grants a limited license driving privilege to an offender during his or her period of license revocation, the bill requires the use of an IID for repeat offenders or first-time offenders who blow over 0.15. No one will argue that Alaska needs to lower its DUI statistics. I believe that SB 92 is a proactive step in physically reducing the number of vehicles on our roads driven by drunk drivers. Please join me in supporting this legislation. I'd be happy to walk the committee through the sectional analysis, or perhaps just turn it over to questions now We have a person on the line, Ms. Babette Miller from a company called Smart Start. They install these devices. They calibrate these devices. They can answer questions about the technicalities of how it actually works and interrupts the ignition system. I believe also that Lieutenant Dial from the Alaska State Troopers is on the line to answer questions about how these work in the field. I'll just say that there are places in the state where it's difficult, if not impossible, to install these and to make them work. We had a case, for example, from Unalaska, where it was going to cost the offender $1,000 to fly a technician to Unalaska to install a device, and then another $1,000 to fly out to uninstall it. And so we leave to the commissioner the ability to designate where in the state this is feasible and where it's not feasible. My view is that it's going to be feasible just about anywhere in the rail belt, and in Juneau and other locations where you have a city that can support one of these technicians, but there are going to be places where it's nearly impossible. That will leave up to the commissioner. The idea, of course, is to sort of shoot for the center of the target, get as many as people as possible to install the devices and use them, and to try to keep downward pressure on drunk driving. I wouldn't claim this is a magic bullet. I've gotten lots of comments about how someone else can blow into this. It can be disabled. You know, obviously there's always a way for a person to get around the law, but I think it's incumbent upon ourselves to make the effort to make it more difficult, and in another sense, let someone who is sober back behind the wheel on their probationary period and go about their lives. So with that, I'll turn it over to you, Madam Chair, and other members for questions.
Senator Bundy.
Thank you. And I certainly support the goal, and I've looked at it previously, and one of the things that discouraged me was the scofflaw that could get around the system. So the person that's from the company is online.
Yes.
If I could address a question.
Yes, so the question would be directed to Ms. Babette Miller. Are you there?
I am.
Okay, so Senator Bundy has a question or a series of them directed at you.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
You have experience in other states with the interlock device?
Yes, we do.
Okay, and I'm just wondering if you're aware of what the cheating rate is. Are there people picked up for DUI that have an interlock device and are still driving under the influence? And
I do.
What percentage or what rate that would occur?
I do not have numbers on that, but I can get those numbers and send them to you.
It would be interesting to know if it's not a great inconvenience. And I understand that, you know, some people can. The new interlocks are more sophisticated. Does it just take a puff of air, or does it actually have to have the chemical composition of the air of that we might exhale, you know, with carbon dioxide and that sort of thing in it?
How our interlock works is the breath sample that they provide is a total of 7 seconds. The first 3 seconds they blow into the unit. For the remainder of the test, they blow and hum into the unit. It has a voice detection system built into it so that an individual is not allowed to use an air tank to blow into the unit. It looks for a voice also.
Okay, thank you. That's smart.
You're welcome.
Further questions?
So I'll follow up on that.
Yes, Senator Stevens.
Could you explain that voice detection system? So that you really know then that the person who's blowing into that is the person who's not supposed to be driving? Or does it just ensure you that this is a voice?
It just ensures you that it's a voice. And our new unit that is actually out in the lower 48 right now and is not approved for Alaska yet, and hopefully will be within the next 6 months, actually takes a picture of the individual that's blowing into the unit.
I see.
Yeah.
If I could follow up, Madam
Chair. Sure, Senator Stevens.
Could you talk to us about the cost of this? Its cost is going to be borne by the offender. Any idea what we're talking about in terms of what the offender will have to pay?
When we do installs here in Alaska, it's $100 for the install, and it's $125 a month for their lease cost.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Further questions, Senator Stevens? Senator Bundy, I still...
Thank you. And for Senator French, again, just assuming any time someone builds a better lock, someone finds a better hacksaw. If, for instance, Southeastern here, someone who lived in Juneau would get an interlock. But if they went to Cake and bought a car and put it on the ferry, they could come back to Juneau and not... And it could escape the interlock. Is there a way, or have you thought about how we could attempt to include more people, particularly where they have access to the Marine Highway or any of the road system?
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, I don't see this as being driven like the emissions program on where your car is registered. I see this driven as where the crime was committed, where you live, and where you're going to be operating the car. These are obviously fact-specific inquiries that I would anticipate the department would take into account before it grants a waiver, if you will, around the IID. But I don't see it as being something you can avoid just by running and buying a car in a remote area and pretending as if you live there. We have ways of checking where a person lives. The permanent fund dividend is a good check. Where you work is another good check, and you know where you've lived in the past. And I would expect that the folks at the Department of that are making the decision would take a fairly flinty-eyed view towards someone who is trying to run around the law by claiming to live in a remote area.
If I might follow, that, as you anticipated, the department would make a case-by-case decision and not just say, "Well, you're from Bethel, so we don't have to. You don't have to be involved."
I think probably a mixture of both. I mean, there'll be a hybrid. From time to time, you know, if there's no other extenuating circumstances, a case that began in Unalaska, ended in Unalaska, involves an Unalaska person, you know, the department would say, fine, you don't have to have this interlock because it costs you $1,000 to put it on your car, and it costs someone from Anchorage $100 or $225 for the first month. So that's my anticipation is that they'll develop regional exemptions.
If I might, and then regarding the cost, there will obviously be some who will claim poverty and unable to pay. Do you have an idea what percentage they will be and what, and I assume then the state will pick up the tab?
My reaction is no, the state won't pick up the tab. Driving is a
privilege.
Right, a privilege and not a right. And if you know, it's like a lot of things. If you can't afford SR-22, if you can't afford the car itself, you know, the state isn't going to put you behind the wheel of a car and pay for the insurance. Likewise, if you can't satisfy this condition of your sentence, you'll need to relocate yourself near a bus line and, you know, live where and work where you can use public transportation. There's no question there's a huge cost involved. But, I mean, you know where my sympathies are. They're with people that get hurt by drunk drivers.
Madam Chair, then just for the record, and I certainly agree that it is the intent of this legislation that whoever's the perpetrator pay for it and there not be any exemption or a state responsibility to pay for this program.
I would resist that. I would resist that.
Senator Green.
I was trying to figure out what is the point of infraction, because many families have many cars. And if you're only, is it the fact that you're driving a car that does not have an interlock device that's the offense, or that you've disabled it in some way, or is it the fact that, where does the infraction start? What is the penalty for?
Well, it would be, that's a good question. Thank you for asking. The onus, of course, would be on the person convicted of the offense. He or she must, if driving, be behind the wheel of an of a car equipped with an IID. Mm-hmm. If he or she wants to drive a car without one of those IIDs, then he or she is breaking the law.
Okay.
Other family members, of course, can use the car with or without it at their leisure. They're not under the provisions of this of the bill. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, but okay. That brings about another question.
Okay.
Okay. If this person convicted got into a car that has a IID in it, will it start if that person doesn't blow into it?
No.
Okay.
So someone has to supply clean air to that non-alcoholic air to that.
So anyone could get in the car
and blow into it and make it go.
Okay, right. Very good. Thank you. Thanks.
Clean air. Okay. Further questions for Senator French? Okay. So further questions for Babette Miller from Smart Start? Okay, we also have Dwayne Bannock online from DMV to answer questions. Questions for Dwayne. Okay, Dwayne, thanks for being online. Is there anything you want to add on the record? There are no questions for you, but did you want to make a statement on the record or not?
No, thank you, Madam Chairman. Thank you.
Okay, and next, Lieutenant Dial with the Alaska State Troopers. Any questions for him? Lieutenant, did you want to make any statement on the record?
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rodney Dial. I'm a lieutenant with Alaska State Troopers, been on the department for about 17 years. I would just like to say that the Department of Public Safety fully supports Senate Bill 92 as a further step towards reducing impaired driving. I'd like to point out a couple other things, too, that having this device in a vehicle is not only a reminder for the individual that they have an alcohol problem, but it's also, in essence, a notification to others who might ride with that individual in the vehicle that the driver is under certain restrictions. I personally made hundreds of DUI arrests in my career, and I'm constantly amazed at the percentage of drivers that I arrest out of a vehicle for DUI who have a sober person sitting in the passenger seat. So we're fairly excited about this, that this will reduce some of the impaired drivers on our roads and will make Alaska highways safer. And I just stand by to answer any questions anybody may have. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Lieutenant. Is there anybody else here in the audience that wishes to testify that has not signed up? Anybody online that I've overlooked? Okay, hearing none. Public testimony is closed on Senate Bill number 92. Further committee discussion. Senator Bundy.
Just thinking about, thank you, Madam Chair, thinking about the goal of the bill sponsored, that if you can't afford an interlock, you don't drive. I'd encourage him to think a little bit more than about the remote areas. If you can't afford an interlock that's going to cost you $1,000, maybe you ought not to drink also. And if we're going to say you live in a city and you don't have $300, you're not going to drive. Let's say if you live in Bethel and you don't have $500, you're not going to drive. So, and places where alcohol costs $300 and $400 a gallon bootleg, perhaps there is the money available if there's the will. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Further questions or committee discussion?
Just a point out,
Senator French.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the studies that, with respect to how well it works and whether it can be gotten around, there's a study that we have access to that shows that repeat offenses are decreased up to 80% within the first year of ignition interlock device usage. It does seem to have some effect on pushing down repeat offenders. And I think we've all seen, especially the letter of support, I think, from one of the groups really points out the harm done by high alcohol repeat offenders. They just seem to be at the heart of the cases where those heartbreaking cases where we have, you know, innocent people killed by repeat high alcohol offenders. And it's my hope, of course, that we can eliminate those. This bill won't eliminate them, but it'll keep downward pressure on those incidents.
Senator Green.
I have another question, actually. On page 7, in the amendments to what the court shall impose, you have accelerated fines, monetary fines. So I would tend to agree with Senator Bundy that if those fines aren't by region, why would the availability of the interlock installation or convenient be an exception? Because those are applied throughout the state, are they not? Those monetary amounts?
Absolutely. The fines are uniform. Mm-hmm. And I think, I mean, that's perhaps that's why, you know, we don't fine people in Bethel $5,000 and people in Anchorage $1,000.
Right.
We fine everybody the same. If an ignition interlock is three times more expensive somewhere else or four times more expensive, I just think it's, I mean, at some point, there has to be, I think, some allowance for the fact that it's just not available statewide. Perhaps if the technology gets a little less expensive as it becomes more comprehensive, you know, this idea of a cell, it sounds like a cell phone takes a picture of the person that gives a sample now. It probably won't be long before that image has to match up with the image on file before it works at all. But for the time being, it just strikes me that at some level you have to account for the fact that the costs are just too disproportionate in different parts of the state.
Follow-up, Senator Green?
No.
Senator Stevens?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I've been just thinking here about motor vehicles, but does this apply also to snow machines and other pieces of equipment? Could it?
Can we get Ms. Miller back on the line?
Is it too late? Remote areas, you know, that might be a bigger problem. And of course, when you read in the newspapers that often there are incidents that occur with snow machines and other equipment.
I'd hate to put them on a boat.
Ms. Miller, are you on the line?
I am.
It's an interesting question. Has your company, or are you aware of any other companies that have installed interlock devices on other types of motor vehicles?
As far as I'm aware, they don't install them on vehicles that do not have an area to protect the unit from the environment, from the outside environment. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So no ATVs, no snowmobiles, no motorcycles.
Okay. And just on the point that Senator Green makes, I think it's a really good one, and Senator Bundy. And I think that, you know, this is where we as a legislature, I think, just need to continue the downward pressure on getting the availability of these interlock devices into those communities, because all it says is that if it's unavailable, then they don't have to have it. It really doesn't mention cost. So I think, you know, again, driving is a privilege. If you've got a problem, we know that the interlock device absolutely reduces recurrence rates. Not 100%, but it's a high figure. Senator French says 80%. I've heard figures right around there. So I think it's incumbent on us to try and, where we can, increase the availability, encourage the availability of those interlock devices in outerlying areas as well, whatever it takes. Okay, so further discussion. Further amendments? Senator Bundy?
Well, I would propose an amendment.
Okay.
And that is to delete on page 10, lines 12 through 15, where it gives the Department of Admin the ability to determine that interlocks are not unavailable. And as was mentioned earlier, we're talking about $5,000 and $6,000 fines. It seems as if that the cost of another $1,000 for an interlock is not substantial.
Say the line number again there.
Oh, it's line 12, section.
There you go.
Paren, small v, paren. Line 12 through 15. I suspect the Department of Administration would tend not to be lenient, but this is a very broad allowance for them. You know, as you say, unavailable. I could consider them unavailable in Talkeetna too.
Okay, so amendment number one would be to strike be subsection V essentially, and the net effect of that would then be that somebody who is required to use one where it was unavailable simply would not drive their car. Okay, Senator Green.
If the maker of the amendment would look on page 2, you may want to expand his amendment to include the language on lines 16.
Yeah. And line 16?
Line 16,
yeah.
17, 18?
Yeah, that'd just have to, for conformity, you would have to.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay, so we've all heard amendment number one. Senator French, do you want to?
Along those same lines as the observation Senator Green just made, there's a reference on page 7, lines 5 through 8. If we're going to, we may as well take up this issue all at once and excise.
Okay.
It's essentially the same language that's on page 10.
That's correct.
For the record, it's page 7, lines 5 through 8.
Also V.
Madam Chair, if I could.
Senator Bundy?
Withdraw my amendment and rephrase it to say that we'd remove all references to making the interlock device optional.
Okay, and waiver for it. Senator French, are there any other sections that you could draw our attention to that we're overlooking? Senator French's staff.
Help us beat up on your bill.
Given the nature, the phraseology of the amendment, I think it's clear that what the intent is.
So we'll make it a conceptual amendment, and the drafter can look for any place that might be referenced. We think we've got it. Page 2, line 16 through 18. Page 7, lines 5 through 8. And finally, page 10, lines 12 through 15. We think we've got it. That's amendment number one. I'll object just to hear, I don't object to the amendment, but I'm going to object just to hear Senator French's response if he has any.
It really boils down to proportionality. I just think at some level it's not fair to say to someone, you know, it's going to cost you $1,000 to install this device. It's going to cost this other person $125. I'm a hardcore DWI prosecutor. I have very little tolerance for it, but I just think it boils down to a question of fairness. And so for that reason, I guess I'm willing to wait for the technology to catch up to the more remote parts of the state, aim for the center of the target, which is the rail belt and other associated urban areas, and cope with the rest of the state when the technology improves.
Okay, further discussion on the amendment? Anybody else want to weigh in, Senator Stevens?
I certainly have some concerns about that when I think about some of the remote villages that I'm familiar with, and this draconian approach that really forces them to be unable to drive, and in villages, almost always in villages, there's no public transportation, and you're pretty much stuck. So, I guess I would have a concern with removing this wording.
And quickly, before I get to Senator Bundy, Ms. Miller, maybe you're aware. Is Smart Start operating in Alaska right now?
Yes, we are.
Okay.
And we go out to a lot of the remote areas, and what we do is we take a list. So if an individual needs an ignition interlock in Nome, let's say, we start a list, and once we have 4 or 5 people on that list, we then go out and provide the service, and we do not pass the airfare on to them. We bite that cost, and at that point, when we go to that remote area, we've, you know, taken a loss. We do that with approximately 2 remote areas at a time. We are currently, and we, you know, are expanding into as many areas as we can. We're currently hiring contractors in outlying areas. We have them in Dillingham, Kodiak, Sitka, Ketchikan, Juneau. Our competitor has them in Bethel. So we will not expand to Bethel as long as he's providing the service there. And, you know, we try to ensure that we cover as many areas as we can. On Alaska, because that was used as an example, we've actually had 2 people that have called from there. And we have both of them on a list. And once we pull out of another area that we're in at a loss, if that area still needs the service, we will go into that area and install the units and try to find a contractor there.
Okay. Senator Bundy.
Well, regarding the remote and rural areas, I'm not necessary to point out the level of alcohol abuse that we have in rural Alaska even exceeds what we have in urban Alaska, which is way too high. But I believe this is deals with traffic laws, and those only apply to state roads. And so in many places, the really small villages, they virtually don't have any state roads. And so I don't know if you could, you can get a DUI for driving on private property or across the tundra.
Quick answer.
Senator French.
Short answer is yes.
Yeah.
Yep. There are insurance laws that don't apply. There are license requirements laws that don't apply, but you can get a DWI sitting in a parking
driveway.
Lot. Yep. Or in your driveway or off in a snow berm or anywhere. It's all encompassing.
Okay.
But I do have a follow-up question for Ms. Miller, because maybe I was misinformed.
Senator French.
While you're on the line, Ms. Miller, do you charge the same price for your service no matter where your customer is in the state?
In the areas that we fly to, we charge $150 for the install, so the install cost is $50 more.
And what about the monthly charge?
It's $125.
Same as everywhere else?
Yep.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Senator Stevens.
So just so I understand the intention of this, the result of removing this waiver. So if one lived in a small community in which this was not available, and we remove this waiver issue, then if you were to drive sober, you'd be in violation of the law if this waiver is taken out. It just seems like that's an enormous, I mean, I understand what Senator Bundy is saying, and I'm not, and I don't know about the statistics about rural Alaska versus urban Alaska, but it'd be interesting to know what those statistics actually are, but it seems to me, that it's probably a wise idea to leave the waiver in, at least for the time being.
Senator French.
Maybe maybe the solution is to get a list to the committee so that we can see where it's going to be imposed, so we can make a more informed decision. We're not just shooting in the dark.
Okay.
Maybe we should hold the bill over for to the next hearing and let the department at least give us a idea of where it's going to be required, where not.
Yeah.
And I guess the only other thing I would say is I would just remind the committee that this is about repeat offenders. This is not about a first-time DWI offender who's made a mistake, had a brush with the law, learned his lesson, and cleaned up. It's for a person who's on a second or subsequent DWI, or someone who's had an extremely high BAC the first go-around, which speaks. I think it's important to keep that in mind.
And on that point, the other thing we're talking about is a limited license, which again is a privilege within a privilege. You're a repeat offender, you've broken the law multiple times, and now we're allowing you to drive on a limited basis. And in exchange for that very gracious privilege, we're asking that an interlock device be installed to put you in between your drinking problem and the wheel of your car, and to protect those out on the road. And I'm leaning toward the amendment because of the privilege part, and because I believe that at the end of the day, that interlock is maybe the only thing that separates that problematic alcoholic, that separates them from their car and their drinking. And so I want to think about it. Let's hold the bill over, if that's okay. And I'd like to get a list of where these services are being provided. I think that's a fair question. I think Senator Stevens has made good points. So let's hold the bill over. Senator Bundy?
Just a question for Ms. Miller while we have her online. Did I understand correctly that if you have to fly out somewhere, you charge an extra $50 for the installation, but the monthly fee is the same throughout the state? Ms. Miller?
I hesitate to answer in her place, but I think that's what we all heard her say.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. That is correct.
So the notion, the example was given that it would cost $1,000 probably doesn't reflect reality. It would really only be an extra $50.
It depends on which place you call. Our competitor does pass on the airline cost, and we do give the individuals the option to pay the airline cost if they do not want to wait for 4 or 5 individuals to be required to have it.
and put them in a position of pulling for DWIs. But,
yeah, get their neighbor.
Well, thank you.
We don't want to do that.
They do have the option, though maybe not a pleasant option. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. Senator Stevens.
As long as we're getting information, Madam Chair, I think it would be of value in knowing the statistics of DWIs around the state. I mean, for example, villages Old Harbor and Eliamna, they may not have any DWIs. I don't know. But it would be nice to know that, and that would speak to me to allowing this waiver. But anyway, I'd like to have a little more information if we can.
Okay, so looking for some
geographic distribution of DWIs,
right.
And a list where the department would be granting waivers.
Where they would be granting waivers, yep, and where commiserate with that, where we have current providers. And I think it'd be nice to know what those contracts, I think we kind of know based on testimony from Ms. Miller that some companies put in the airline costs if there aren't enough folks in the group, 150 and 125. There is a different company. It'd be nice to know that company's policy. I think she said they're providing in Bethel, and I'm not sure where else.
Yeah, I heard her say, and they were passing on the costs.
Right.
We'll look into that.
I think okay, so we'll go ahead and hold this bill over until next Tuesday, Senate Bill number 92, and that'll be first up on next Tuesday. Okay, so that brings us to Senate Bill number, my apologies. Is there anybody else here today that needs to, wishes to testify on Senate Bill number 92 that won't be here next Tuesday? Anybody online? Okay. Hearing none, then we will go ahead and move on to Senate Bill number 33. And we do have a CS that needs adopting. Can I have a motion?
Madam Chairman, I've moved the CS for Senate Bill number 33 /C be considered the bill before us.
Okay. Is there an objection to that motion? Hearing none, we have /C before us. Senator Bundy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And might I invite Ms. Alberts to join me at the witness table, my extended memory. Madam Chair and committee members, what we have before us is the 21st century version of fingerprints. currently, under our law, someone who's convicted as a felony or a crime against a person, as they do in 44 other states, DNA samples are collected. And just a quick review of how DNA is collected. It's simply a swab of the cheek area. It doesn't require anything invasive or needles or anything at that time. Senate Bill 33 would allow a DNA sample to be taken at the time of arrest, along with the fingerprints that are already a matter of course, if the person's arrested for a felony or a crime against a person. Unfortunately, I think many of us understand that when a person is arrested, all too often that's not their first crime. It's just the first time they've been caught, or been caught this time, I guess. And we have examples in other states where this is working quite well. 7 other states allow this to happen currently, where at the time of arrest a DNA sample has been taken. And I would add here that I have had a DNA sample taken on just a genealogy project, and I was able to take it for myself. You simply take a cotton swab and swab the inside of your cheek. So again, it's not not threatening or highly invasive procedure. Often suspects, as I've said, who are arrested on a particular crime can be involved in unsolved crimes. The reverse is also true. DNA is doing wonders nowadays, I feel, in exonerating people who are falsely accused. And so we should look at both sides of that equation, that it isn't just we're going to use it to get the bad guys. We also have a chance to protect those that are falsely accused. This certainly allows us to solve crimes faster. As I said, it frees the innocent. It certainly frees up the criminal justice system. We don't have people incarcerated waiting for trials and clogging up the jails. So We had an earlier discussion off the record that if the charges are dropped, if the arrest is erroneous, the conviction is reversed, the DNA sample would be destroyed and expunged from the database. So this isn't a case of Big Brother getting records on all its citizens. It would only be there if it need to be used for law enforcement purposes. Unlike fingerprinting, federal law does provide some protection in that it has up to a $250,000 fine or imprisonment for 1 year for intentional misuse or unauthorized disclosure of DNA data. So again, protecting privacy while still providing for the public's safety and getting the bad guys off the street. Let me stop there, ask Jane if I've skipped over anything important, and make myself available for questions.
For the record, my name is Jane Alberts, a staff to Senator Bundy, and to the extent that I can support his testimony, I believe you've covered most of our points today. I might want to add that there is federal funding out there and an idea that needs to be explored further, but federal funding for lab expansion, and there's no match required, but we do not have all the information on that as of yet.
And with that in mind, Madam Chair, we do have folks from the crime lab online to be able to testify. I noticed the commissioner is with us today as well. There is a fiscal note, and I rush to acknowledge that this is not inexpensive. It's over $300,000 initially, and then a couple of $100,000 a year. Again, the price of public safety is something we have to weigh as we go through this process.
Okay, anything further? Okay, questions for the bill sponsor at this time? Senator Green.
Yeah, it's not really a question, but I think for people who are listening in or may not have recalled that this is just an amendment to currently enacted law that allows for the collection of DNA, and it just expands who from whom this can be collected.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Green. Yeah, that's true. We currently, as I had mentioned, people who are convicted are required to give up DNA samples. This would expand that to say that people who are arrested for a felony or a crime against a person, not if you're picked up for shoplifting, that's not going to apply. But it's an expansion of the program we already have, and as I said, those people are all fingerprinted now, and I don't hear any outcry that that's an invasion of privacy or these things ought not to be happening, and it seems that, as I said, the DNA is the 21st century equivalent of a fingerprint, and only it's far more accurate.
Okay, and then I just have a question, comment first, but yeah, Senator Green, we, at least over in our Judiciary Committee, since 2000, have been enacting every couple of years. First, there was the implementation of it, which Speaker Porter had started with and was unsuccessful. We finally got it through in a really good compromise in our committee that emphasized the power of DNA evidence to exonerate as well as to incriminate and solve crimes, and as well the very strict penalty that would come from a misuse of that information. Then we went on and we expanded it further with a bill that would actually force individuals who just said, well, we don't mind the charge against us, we're just not going to give it to you because we're in prison for life anyway. And to be blunt, it was aimed at the Butcher Baker scenario. And we will get your DNA from you because we want to solve these crimes. And so we keep expanding. And the question has always been, at what point in the process do you get that DNA? And so it's a policy question. And so that's where we are. My question, Senator Bundy, you just said crimes against a person. And I want to be clear, because I'm looking at Title 11,
And Title 11 actually involves quite a few things. Offenses against a person, offenses against property, offenses against the family, offenses against public administration, public order, and health and decency, controlled substances, and miscellaneous offenses. And so I want to be clear that that's what you intended, that any felony under any crime in Title 11 for which you would be charged with would be included.
Madam Chair, the intention was to match the existing net that is cast on DNA sampling. And we were notified by a prosecutor, I believe, that our verbiage should expand to a crime against a person because that's existing law under the current DNA law.
Correct. Okay. So if the bill were to pass, so just to be clear, shoplifting would be an offense if it rose to a felony level that you would be giving a DNA sample for. Because it's covered under this title.
Yeah, if it's covered under the current DNA requirement, it would continue to be covered.
Depending on the level of it, mm-hmm. in the elements. And then, okay, and then I want to understand my second question, and then let's go to testimony, because generally I am supportive. Just quickly,
whenever you're finished, yeah.
second question, or a law or ordinance with elements similar to a crime. Okay, so tell me what you mean there.
Jane, what do I mean there? That's, again, verbiage from the initial law.
Through the chair, drafted it that way. I haven't put that into a question to them, but they felt that would be the wording to obtain our objective to mirror exactly what we currently do for convicted felons, and that would be the wording if that was our intent.
Okay, so I think what you mean then is if it's a municipal crime or a felon or a federal crime, a crime out of another jurisdiction and so forth, is that what you think? So maybe you get us an answer on that. Senator French.
Madam Chair, I'll just hazard a guess. I'm sure Ms. Salas will get a better answer, but my guess is that the bill picks up not only all felonies but also misdemeanor domestic violence and misdemeanor assault cases. That's what a crime against a person.
So the lesser crimes.
And municipalities have those laws in their books as well. Municipality of Anchorage does, Juneau, Fairbanks, they prosecute those crimes. So anyone charged with a misdemeanor domestic violence case statewide or misdemeanor simple assault, barroom brawl, for example, would be required at the moment of arrest to supply a buccal swab for a DNA sample.
Okay, and that's how we get to shoplifting. Because you've got
well, it's
got
to be a felony. Excuse me, I don't mean to interrupt, but all felonies, any $500 or more shoplifting,
right.
would be a felony. Bad checks, embezzlement, you know, fraud, all white collar crimes would be picked up by this as well, as long as it's a felony level offense. That's the way I read it.
Okay, but you just said, or a law or ordinance with elements similar to a crime or against a person. Okay, so you're saying the lesser degree crimes are only the crimes against a person, not the other parts of Title 11 which relate to property crimes and others?
That's my understanding. I mean, that'd be my read on it.
So I'd like a clarification. I think that's right. I think what you're saying then is all of Title 11, so that can be your above 500 property crime, above $500 property crimes, but then when you go down to the lesser crimes with similar elements, you mean only the crimes against a person. Okay, is that?
And again, we'll get those answers for you, but we didn't add any, we didn't broaden the net. We just added where the sample would be taken. The rest is existing law.
Just want to understand. Okay.
And I have just one other.
Senator French.
And we may as well get it on the table. I think Senator Bundy began to address this, but we're going to hear at some point that, you know, the reminder that people are innocent until they're proved guilty, that if you're arrested for a crime, lots of people get exonerated, charges get dropped, turns out that it was bad information at the arrest and so forth. And while I agree that there are some parallels between a fingerprint and a buccal swab, I don't think the parallels are perfect. I think there's some concern in the public that the you know, unique genetic identifiers that you possess not be disseminated without careful consideration. So I guess I just need to get your response to the innocent until proven guilty idea and get that on the record.
Thank you. And I guess in a more simplistic view, don't see that any more invasive than the fingerprint, but I understand others could. And I mentioned the strong federal prohibition against any misuse of that information, $250,000 fine, year in jail. And then the fact that if charges are dropped, the arrest wasn't valid, that information is then destroyed. So, I mean, it's again, we constantly do the balancing act of not trying to inconvenience honest people, but yet trying to protect them from those who would abuse our privileges.
Senator Green?
You know, I think an update on the success of the current DNA collection system would be kind of to validate where Senator Bundy's going and broaden that net and solve crimes from the past.
Okay, we do have some folks from the Department of Public Safety that I think will be able to help us there. And I understand exactly what Senator French is saying because I lived through these debates. Whoa, way too many times. And there is a point, and eventually, just to be very clear so we know where we're headed, the bill that we arrived at was a compromise. And we cut it off at that point of charging an indictment and said it will be once you're convicted. And that was the point of compromise in our committee. We may choose to pull that back further because there is tremendous evidence that I think you'll hear that, well, frankly, one person said at one point, if you just were to take the DNA of every citizen in the entire United States, you'd probably find some interesting things anyway, never mind being charged with the crime. So we could go that direction too, but it's just a question of where we want to cut it off. The next part about DNA that makes it a little bit different that I'll put on the record than a fingerprint, and I know Senator Bundy knows this, but you know, DNA contains it contains elements of your family's history, your family's privacy, your family's potential propensities for certain things like cancers and others. And the more research that's done with DNA, the more interesting it becomes. And so it's just something to think about, that when you're giving your fingerprint, that really is a unique identifier to you. DNA, we have shown, is also an identifier to others within your family as well. So,
Madam Chair, if I could address Senator Green's question, in some of the backup information, it indicates here that in Virginia, which began collecting DNA from arrestees in 2003, have solved 222 crimes linked to those arrestees. Now, this wasn't, they've collected it from arrestees. And in Chicago, a study has documented that 60 violent crimes could have been prevented if the perpetrator had been required to submit a DNA sample at arrest. And they went on and, of course, created 60 more victims and then were arrested and convicted.
And Senator Bundy, you might go back, and we had a wonderful presentation, PowerPoint, and I could go back and find out who did it, but they went through and they were advocating that we do just what you're doing this bill today, and again, we reached that compromise position, but they were able to show some incredible trends in places where they had drawn the line, and the further you go, the more crimes you end up solving. So I'll try to get track down that name for you. Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a little curious about how this works, Senator Bundy. On the surface, I guess I wasn't too concerned about people gathering DNA, but I think the chairman has made a good point of information on health conditions that could be available. And so if someone is arrested and the DNA is taken, immediately that the results would be broadcast around the country to find out, does this person have a background that we need to investigate? Have they committed a crime somewhere else?
And so you're immediately sending that information everywhere. And if you find the person is innocent then, through a long court system, how do you retract that? How do you get it back? I mean, it seems to me almost, it's almost impossible.
Madam Chair, we have the crime lab on, and I don't think it is immediately broadcast. It's kept in a file, and if folks have reason to then address that file, they are addressed. And it doesn't, as I understand it, and I don't want to get beyond my expertise here, but the crime lab can help me here. Many of those more intricate things of family health history and propensity for disease and all that sort of thing, I don't believe the DNA testing goes that deep for this purpose. If I could refer to the crime lab to help answer.
Yeah, I think it's a relevant point. Okay, so I have two folks online. I'm not sure whom is more qualified to answer. They're both online to answer questions. Catherine Manfreda and Michelle Collins. I'll just throw it out to both of you there. Well, let's start with Ms. Manfreda. Can you respond to the question that Senator Stevens just posed and that sort of the line of discussion that we've had?
Madam Chairman, Michelle Collins is much more qualified to answer that question. Okay. She's here in the room with me.
Fantastic. Ms. Collins?
Yes. Through the chair, Senator Stevens, as has been discussed there in the committee, what we are actually looking at when we're doing our DNA testing is just a few very small portions of the DNA when compared to the actual size of a DNA molecule. And the places that we are looking at, while they are do show uniqueness between individuals, those are not locations that have any relation to disease or health history or anything like that. These are locations that exist but don't necessarily perform a function in the body other than that they're just there.
Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Ms. Collins. So my question really is, can you put Humpty Dumpty back together again once you've taken him apart? And so if I understand this right, the police arrest someone, and you want to know if this person has done a similar crime. So I assume you would broadcast that DNA about the country to, say, Florida, find out, has this guy done similar crimes in that state? So my concern then is, if you find him innocent, how do you remove all of that material from the database? How do you retrieve everything that you broadcast?
Well, everything that when you say broadcast, what actually happens is the samples are uploaded to a national database that is held and governed by the FBI, and then the FBI has a link to all the other states. The state of Alaska doesn't directly link up to other states. We link only to the FBI, and the FBI links to all the states. And when either charges are dropped, or as is the case right now, if a conviction is overturned, the court issues a court order to the lab to destroy that sample and remove the profile, and that is done. We remove it here at the state level, and then that information is forwarded to the national lab, and it is pulled out of their database. It's never actually housed in another state. It's housed here and at the national level, and that profile is removed and the sample destroyed if a court order is received indicating that the charges were dropped or the person was acquitted or a conviction was overturned.
Well, thank you for explaining that.
Okay, and on that point, and then to Senator French, when it goes in, and I assume you're referring to CODIS.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, so, and this is just a procedural question of interest. So once that sample is uploaded into CODIS, at that point and disseminated to all the states, I assume those states are going to begin the process of seeing whether or not they match other people in their system and other crimes, even prior to the resolution of the charge or indictment. Is that correct?
The, samples that are housed in the arrestee index, that's what it's called in the CODIS database, those are allowed to be searched, but they're not actually searched by the other states. Again, all that information is retained by the FBI, and they do the searching for us, and then they notify us if we have a match to a sample from any other state.
Madam Chair, could you
Senator Stevens?
Ms. Collins, identify what you mean by it. Define, is it CODA?
CODIS. It's an acronym, CODIS. It's the Combined DNA Index System. And that's the database that was created and is regulated by the FBI. And then individual states participating with their convicted samples, arrestees in some states, and also crime scene samples.
Thank you.
By the way, you can get them off cigarettes and coffee cups now.
Yep.
Senator French.
Thank you. Just to follow up on the line of inquiry that Senator Stevens began, once that DNA sample is uploaded into CODIS, maybe you can tell me, are searches continuous? Are states trying to solve cold cases by continually sort of re-inquiring of the CODIS database whether perhaps a match has been found from to crime scene evidence that they've gathered at various points in their investigations?
Through the chair, yes, that is. The FBI actually conducts a search of everything in the national index once a week. So as additional samples are uploaded to the national index, they are searched against all the samples that are already in that index.
So let me just, you know, maybe put it in concrete terms. Let's just assume that there are 10,000 unsolved cases out there. And let's just assume that once a week the FBI inquires of the CODIS database whether a match has been found for any of those unsolved cases. And a person is arrested in Alaska, sample is taken, uploaded into the database, assuming this all happens in a timely manner. And, mm-hmm. and frankly, I think there's going to be several weeks before that sample gets put into the lab and uploaded. But assuming that all happens, and bingo, you get a hit. A New York rape case is solved by matching crime scene evidence found at the scene with the buccal swab taken from an arrestee in Alaska. Irrespective of whether that person later gets found completely innocent here in Anchorage of the crime that he was charged with or the charges are dropped, that match is going to exist, and that person's now caught, mm-hmm. for better or for worse. That person's now for better. I think it's what someone was about to say.
Yeah.
That's justice. So that's the policy choice we're making, yep. But it's also how the system I envision working. Is that about right?
Yes, I would say if everything happens in a timely fashion, and yes, once the match is made, you can't undo the match, and we do confirmation processes and such, and then we would put an investigator on this end in contact with someone with the case in New York, and then it would be up to them to pursue it further.
And just one last follow-up question. Is there a parallel system in place for fingerprints in the National Fingerprint Database?
Yes, there is.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Stevens.
Well, I'm surrounded by attorneys, and and my knowledge is pretty much from television, so of crime shows. So I guess my question might be, Senator French, or whoever wants to answer it, that I'm always hearing that if you arrest someone on the street and you stop them for something you think they've done wrong and you find something else in the car, a drugstore, I mean, Is this going to hold up in court if you arrest someone for one crime and you find they've committed another crime? Is there any problem with false arrest there? Or?
We should probably hear from the Department of Law on this, but I guess probably the short answer is no. As long as it wasn't a false arrest or a malicious arrest or an arrest done with the intent of just getting a buccal swab, as long as it was a facially, you know, sort of valid arrest, which 99% of them are, I think you'd have a hard time. As the witness said, sort of undoing the match. The fact is that this person's DNA matches the crime scene in New York in our example, and his DNA. I'm sure there are other perspectives. There's no black and white in the law, and so it's a good question.
Just to comment, I was just going to make the same point, and kind of goes something like this. I'm listening to you talk on the phone about something that doesn't sound too good, and I shouldn't be listening to you, but I can find another way to find out what it is that you said you did. And my hunch is that if it was challenged, which I don't know if it was or wasn't, it'd be interesting to know, actually, whether or not there has been somebody whose DNA has been taken in an arrest, who later went on to be linked to a crime in another state and then ultimately charged with it, and the underlying arrest or crime for which they're arrested was dismissed, whether or not a challenge could be made by that individual that DNA should not have been provided as evidence. My hunch is that they'll get the evidence some way, just the way I said before, that they'll go ahead and have another way of getting at it. But that would be something I'd like to know. I don't know. And maybe somebody from Department of Law could walk us through how that works, because it is interesting. If somebody is, and maybe they did do bad things in other places, but if they end up not being found guilty of the crime for which the DNA was taken, what do you do? Senator Bundy?
Yeah, Madam Chair, and I'm way out of my element, but I think there's a phrase that you lawyers use, the poison fruit or the fruit of the poison tree, that if it was a trumped-up charge that led to the initial arrest, then that DNA sample could not be used.
And I don't disagree. It's the fruit of the poison tree, and I don't disagree. The only thing is that, you know, what you learn in criminal procedure is you have good you have good legislators and bad legislators. You have good cops and bad cops. You have good prosecutors and bad prosecutors. And those that would not want to follow the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution regarding search and seizure might want to take that fruit from that poisonous tree and find another tree to pick it from, in short. So
I love this attorney talk. You know, I mean,
with that, let's hold over the bill and bring it back up next week. And let's have, if you would, Senator Bundy, have Department of Law, if we could.
Sure.
And with that, we're adjourned.